This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 6, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Obama outlines a housing plan as communities hit by foreclosures launch their own responses to the crisis. Immigration activists called the Dream Nine continue to highlight U.S. detention policies from a privately run center in Arizona. And women across the globe use social media to combat online sexism and threats of violence. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Hundreds of armored vehicles are roaming the streets of Sana'a today as the U.S. airlifts all non-essential staff from the embassy in Yemen. The State Department also urged U.S. civilians in the country to leave. The U.K. withdrew all staff from its embassy today. The heightened security coincides with two drone strikes that killed at least four people overnight. The four were reportedly suspected al-Qaeda members. The Yemen Post reports that drones are patrolling the skies over Sana'a as U.S. government offices in 19 Mideast cities remain closed. More than a dozen protesters continue their hunger strike in Chicago today. Three local hospitals have agreed to engage in dialogue that could give 12 undocumented patients potentially life-saving transplants, but protesters say they'll continue until all local hospitals agree to put undocumented patients on transplant lists. Teresa Campagna reports from Chicago.
14 protesters began their fasts 1 week ago. According to organizer and hunger striker Father Jose Landaverde, Obamacare is condemning the undocumented, and one hospital has been quietly deporting undocumented patients to hospitals outside the U.S. An April investigation reveals hundreds are deported regularly under what some medical centers call medical repatriation. Blanca Gomez is an undocumented patient and mother.
What can I say to Obama? To support us, not to leave us die. We don't want to die.
Gomez told FSRN she will need a kidney transplant in the near future. On Wednesday, protesters will go to Advocate Christ Hospital. The hospital made local news last year after Guileno Ojeda died 10 days after they deported him to a hospital in Mexico. As the immigration reform debate continues, protesters hope their actions will garner what they say is an important conversation hospitals and legislators around the country must have. Teresa Campagna, FSRN, Chicago.
Seven members of the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Council were arrested early this morning in northern Idaho as they led a human blockade against a giant piece of oil extraction equipment being shipped to the Alberta tar sands. Lee Robartis has more.
Nearly 200 tribal members and allies stood their ground at the border of the Nez Perce Reservation, home of the Nimiipuu people, blocking the path of a 644,000-pound wastewater evaporator owned by General Electric. State officials granted a travel permit for the megalode Friday, despite a federal court ruling that Forest Service approval was required. That approval was specifically denied, and Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Supervisor Rick Brazell wrote to the shipping company restating that the Forest Service will not consent, approve, or otherwise authorize passage of the megalodes until a number of conditions are met, including consultation with the Nez Perce tribe. Tribal Chair Silas Whitman said consultation never happened.
General Electric decided that corporate America is more responsible than the federal government, and not even considering talking to the tribal governments or the people who live here.
About a dozen were arrested. At 2:30 a.m., state police allowed the giant piece of tar sands equipment through. The megalode stopped short of its first night destination, setting the stage for another possible confrontation tonight. Lee Robartis, FSRN, Moscow.
The UN Human Rights Office is concerned about new anti-terrorism laws recently passed in Bahrain, saying the laws may violate international human rights standards. Patrick Maigua reports from the UN.
The Law on the Protection of Society from Acts of Terrorism recommends increasing the detention period or revoking the citizenship of anyone found guilty of committing or inciting an act of terrorism. The law also provides for the banning of sit-ins, rallies, and other gatherings in the capital, Manama. The UN Human Rights Office says although it is the responsibility of states to maintain law and order, Such responsibility must be exercised within international human rights standards. Cecile Pouli is the spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva.
We welcome the recommendation by the Parliament that basic liberties, particularly freedom of opinion, should not be affected to maintain a balance between law enforcement and human rights protection. We reiterate our concern about the restrictions on public demonstration and other public gatherings.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the government of Bahrain to fully comply with its international human rights commitments, including respect for freedom of expression and peaceful assembly and association. Patrick Maigua, United Nations Radio, Geneva.
And in Detroit, voters are at the polls today to select two candidates who will vie for the job as the city's mayor in November. Republican Governor Rick Snyder stripped local leaders of authority in March. Under emergency manager Kevin Orr, Detroit filed the largest city bankruptcy in U.S. history, with debt as high as $20 billion. The courts have yet to decide if the city is eligible, leaving 30,000 residents uncertain about the future of their pensions and health care. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. In his speech in Phoenix, Arizona today, President Obama outlined a plan to help struggling homeowners and renters across the country. The plan includes measures he has called for before, including programs to help underwater mortgage holders refinance and funding to renovate abandoned homes. He also called for winding down the controversial mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But local governments and activists in communities devastated by the foreclosure crisis aren't waiting for the federal government to act. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
President Obama told a Phoenix audience Tuesday that the housing market is healing, with home values, construction, and sales all on the rise, and foreclosure rates dropping. But in the president's own home city, the view from the ground doesn't look so rosy.
There's all these vacant and foreclosed and abandoned properties that's ripping the city.
Willie Fleming Jr. is a housing rights activist with the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign. He says residents continue to lose their homes, and the promised settlement money and reforms the administration won from big banks last year hasn't made it to homeowners.
There is no enforcement mechanism in the president's plan to ensure that the banks will be doing modifications. That there hasn't been a great deal of success in any of these programs that the president has rolled out since 2009.
The success of some of the president's new plan depends on Congress, which just began a five-week vacation after failing to pass the bill to renew funding for the nation's housing programs. Other measures suggested Tuesday depend on executive branch agencies like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and, most importantly, the Federal Housing Authority. But the authority can't do much until the Senate confirms a full-time director, and the president's pick hasn't received a vote since he was nominated in May. Faced with federal inaction, Fleming and other local activists are organizing on their own.
As our county prepares to put together a land bank, we're working with various community groups throughout the city of Chicago to form community land trusts. It would allow for the community to have democratically controlled of vacant parcels of land. And it allows for the community to redevelop the community and put houses out for rent and houses out for sale.
They're also calling on Chicago officials to consider following in the footsteps of Richmond, California, which last week became the first city in the nation to consider using eminent domain to save homes at risk of foreclosure. The city, which was hit hard by the 2008 housing crash, sent letters to Wells Fargo, Chase, Bank of America, and other major banks last week, offering to buy more than 600 mortgages. If the banks refuse to sell, the city will seize ownership of the homes through eminent domain and reduce the amount people owe on their homes to reflect the current market value.
We're not going to, sit by here in Richmond and allow thousands of more people to lose their homes to foreclosure. We're going to, fight back against these Wall Street bankers.
That's Richmond-based activist David Sharples with the group Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. He He said Wall Street lobby groups like the Securities Investment and Financial Markets Association tried to convince the local city council not to approve this action back in April. When that failed, the group threatened to sue the city and threatened to refuse loans to any Richmond resident. Sharples explained why he thinks the city is within its rights.
The city loses out every time there's a foreclosure through lost tax revenue and having to spend more on code enforcement and policing and other services and maintenance. So, you know, foreclosures have really devastated the neighborhoods in Richmond. And so we've seen a huge amount of blight. You know, you see lots of boarded up houses with, you know, really high grass and weeds growing in the yard. It's bringing down the value of all the other homes on that block. They become magnets for crime.
Other cities struggling to stem the tide of foreclosures, including North Las Vegas and El Monte, California, are currently considering their own eminent domain proposals. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News.
7 of the 9 undocumented activists being held in an Arizona detention center are moving forward with their asylum applications, according to their legal team. The activists known as the Dream 9 crossed the border from Mexico about 2 weeks ago to draw attention to stalled immigration reform and what they call a broken deportation system that breaks apart families. Immigration officials could not confirm to FSRN the specifics of the activists' cases, but said that in order to qualify for asylum, an applicant would have to establish credible fear of risk or death upon return to the home country, in this case Mexico, and would face an immigration judge to make the final decision. As of airtime, all 9 still remain at the Eloy Detention Center in southern Arizona. 2 of them are being held in solitary confinement. For more, we're joined by Alma de Jesus, a Dream activist in California, and Daniel Mateo, the brother of one of the detained activists, Lizbeth Mateo. They're at a sit-in in the office of California Congressmember Javier Becerra in Los Angeles. Alma de Jesus, first describe what's going on now at Congressmember Becerra's office.
Well, right now, it's only Daniel and myself inside the office just because it's a very tiny office and they only allow us both to go in. Our other friends are helping us to make calls to the office to make sure he understands the urgency of making his support to the Dream 9.
I want to go over some of the latest that's been happening with the activist in Arizona. The attorney has said that 7 of them will move forward with their asylum hearing. Do you know what's next for those 7?
Right now, the latest update, as you said, is 7 are approved for credible fear in steps. The process, it's just, we just don't know how long it's going to take. We know people that are inside the detention centers that have waited for almost 2 years for their opportunity to fight their case. And so this is not what we were expecting because it can take longer. We don't know when our friends are going to come back. And right now the urgency is that families need them to go back home.
So those other 2 that you mentioned, Lizbeth Mateo and Marco Saavedra, their status is unknown at this point?
Yes, right now their status is unknown. As you mentioned, only 7 of them have been approved for credible fear. Right now, we understand that that process might take long. We don't know if it's going to take 5 days, 5 months, or years. And so right now we are urging the community to still make those calls to DHS because we need to bring the whole Dream 9 home, not just some of them, but we need to bring them home. And we need them to release them as soon as possible.
They're at the Eloy Detention Center in Arizona. It's a privately run center. It has nearly 1,600 beds, and conditions there have been criticized in the past. Just in May, 2 inmates committed suicide. What are the conditions like there for people, even beyond the Dream 9, for other inmates there?
Yes. The Eloy Detention Center has a big number. It's one of the detention centers that has the highest number of suicides among their detainees. We do know Maria Peniche wanted to hurt herself last week because I believe her self-esteem was very low. We don't know why. We don't know what happened. We just know she wanted to hurt herself. and they put her in a small bed with a plastic bag. And if you know someone wants to hurt themselves, why would you leave a plastic bag inside? And so we don't think they're protecting them, or they're protecting her from doing that. Right now, she's doing better. She hasn't said anything about hurting herself anymore. We do know some of the members of the Gym 9 received a very different treatment than what the other detainees have received. There are different stories about how officers will not feed the detainees if they don't speak in English or if they don't ask for their food in English. And so the Dream 9 are trying to teach them how to ask for their food so they can be fed. So that's one of the reasons that they are being treated with the lack of language. Not just the Dream 9, but the whole detainees in general.
Alma, is Daniel Mateo nearby? Could he talk to us for a moment?
Yes. Give me a second, okay? I just need to get him from the office.
Sure.
Hello?
Daniel Mateo, tell us, how is your family doing? What have you heard from your sister, Lisbeth Mateo, who is in the detention facility in Arizona?
Well, right now, I was talking to Lisbeth a few days ago. She said she's doing fine, but, you know, I'm not sure if that's the truth. You know, maybe she's just, you know, telling us that to keep us calm. I know she lost 11 pounds, which is 10% of her body weight from all the hunger strike that she did. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the conditions inside the detention center are not the best. The other day I found my mom praying for her in the dark, holding a picture of all the 9 students, and she was crying. Whereas right now it's very tough for us. We can't really go on with our daily routine. It's hard for us, you know, to concentrate and not think about my sister and the other 8 dreamers.
Daniel Mateo is brother of Lisbeth Mateo, one of the 9 activists who's in the Arizona detention facility right now. We also spoke with Alma Diaz in Los Angeles. Daniel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
On and offline, women across the globe regularly contend with sexism, misogyny, and threats of violence. Bomb threats made via Twitter to a number of female journalists and historian Mary Beard prompted a protest over the weekend. Some boycotted the social media site. Others used the hashtag #TwitterSilence to pressure Twitter executives to deal with the issue. Another high-profile target was this year's Women's Wimbledon champion, Marion Bartoli. The French tennis star, only the 6th female to win the tournament without dropping a set, faced a barrage of sexist, even violent vitriol on Twitter. And countless other women, from teens to technology experts to activists, experience hostility, sexism, and ignorance on the web. But over the past year, women have been using social media to fight back. FSRN's Cinnamon Apart has more from Berlin.
The Everyday Sexism Project was launched in April 2012 by London resident Laura Bates as a way to document stories of abuse and show the extent of the problem. The concept has quickly spread all over the world. German digital media consultant Anna Witzerek started the Twitter hashtag Aufschrei, which means outcry in English.
Well, it was a very spontaneous thing, actually, because I only started it because I saw another woman who I follow on Twitter, Nicole van Horst. She started sharing her stories, and I saw her tweets, and I was really touched by it, and yeah, just realized how powerful, actually, it is to put such an experience in a tweet, because it's like right down to the core. This is like, this is what happened to me, and this is awful, you know? And I wanted to share my stories as well.
Women tweeted about their experiences of everyday sexism, from wolf whistles and sexist comments to being groped on public transport in broad daylight, being stalked and sexually assaulted. British journalist, author, and contributor to New Statesman magazine, Laurie Penny, says in addition to breaking the silence, these kinds of hashtags fight another aspect of sexualized violence.
When hundreds of people get together and start talking about their experiences, it's that collective sense of fighting shame, which is really important.
Some activists say women are finding strength from this kind of online sharing. Vitarek says that strength has translated into tangible, real-world change, whether that's finding out what their rights are in terms of anti-discrimination laws or having the confidence to speak out.
A lot of women said, well, now I'm more likely if someone attacks me in the street or just, I don't know, just insults me and just harasses me, I'm more likely to say something and more likely to speak up, which I wouldn't have done before Aufschrei.
While hashtags like I Holler Back, Aufschrei, and Everyday Sexism have given women support, Laurie Penny says that some men have been shocked at the degree of sexism women experience daily.
It is going to be really hard for a lot of guys to accept the level of rape and sexual assault that happens, because what that means is that they probably know somebody who's raped somebody. You and I almost certainly know a rapist as well as a rape victim. It's about understanding that ordinary guys, otherwise decent guys, commit acts of sexual violence and assault. They bully women, they discriminate against women, they shut women out of their spaces, and understanding that people we know, and understanding that this is something that comes from us, it's not evil and outside, that's a horrific thing to have to deal with.
Another initiative was started by Melbourne-based student Hilary Bowman. After reading yet another article suggesting that women change their behaviour to avoid sexual violence, like not wearing short skirts or walking down dark alleyways, Bowman started the Twitter hashtag #SafetyTipsForLadies.
I got so frustrated at these absolutely moronic articles that, you know, had no basis in reality. And a lot of the tips that they give are actually extremely impractical, to the point of hilarity. Like, there was a university in the US recently which suggested that if confronted by a potential rapist, women should vomit on themselves or urinate in order to make themselves less attractive.
Bowman points out that many women think about their personal safety all the time. The fact is that not wearing a short skirt and not walking down dark alleyways is no guarantee or protection against rape.
So I just started tweeting some tips that basically poked fun at rape culture. It's an important distinction to make. I don't think rape jokes are funny. I think they're abhorrent.
The tweets use humour to provoke discussion. One states, most rapes happen inside, but they also happen outside. Consider becoming a Schrodinger's cat to confuse your rapist. Another, most rapes happen by people you know. Only talk to strangers. Bowman rolls off a few more.
Men rape for power. Carry AA batteries with you and toss them in front of the rapist to distract him. Then run away. When someone wants to rape you, politely decline. If you're raped, say, I'm a good girl. Since good girls never get raped, the rapist will vanish in a puff of logic.
Despite the humour used, Bowman says the safety tips highlight the hypocrisy of a culture that blames the victim for sexual assault, instead of the rapist for raping.
The reality is that sexual assault can happen to anyone. There's nothing, I guess, that you can do as a victim or a survivor. It's about their behaviour. It's about the behaviour of the perpetrator. And that's a terrifying truth, because that means that there's nothing you can do to be safe.
For Vitarek, Bowman, Penny and other activists, the internet has become a tool to challenge rape culture and to fight for social change. Of course, men also have a part to play in standing up against sexism, and that means calling out their friends on sexist behaviour. Some men are also using the hashtag #EverydaySexism to tweet about sexism that they observe. Laurie Penny says that this is an important step.
When men call other men out, it is unfortunately far more effective than when women call men out. And I think it should be obvious, but it needs to be made more obvious, that this is both a necessary and a rewarding thing for other guys to do.
The Everyday Sexism Project continues to grow. In addition to a strong social media presence, it has websites where women from 16 different countries can share their stories, and one for women refugees. The project also worked with Women, Action and the Media in an international campaign this spring to pressure Facebook to stop allowing violent, misogynist depictions of domestic abuse and rape. After a number of companies pledged to drop advertising on the popular social media site, Facebook agreed to all the campaign's requests, including strengthening hate speech policies and improving training for moderators. Despite this victory, activists say there's much more work to accomplish, and they'll continue pushing for broader discussions of gender bias and equality, both on and offline. Cinnamon Nippard, FSRN, Berlin.
Today, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe spoke before a crowd at Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park, vowing to work toward a world without nuclear weapons. 68 years ago today, U.S. warplanes began a nuclear attack on Japan, dropping an atomic weapon on Hiroshima. 3 days later, on August 9th, the U.S. dropped a second bomb on Nagasaki, killing tens of thousands and causing decades of lasting damage. UN Radio's Jerry Adams reports.
Sachiko Matsuo was a fifth-grade schoolgirl when the atomic bomb destroyed her home in Nagasaki on the 9th of August, 1945. Her family was hiding in the hills on the city's outskirts, where they had built a makeshift hut. She recalls the moment the bomb hit. She was sitting down reading a book.
Suddenly a very strong yellowish-whitish light flashed up over there. When I saw that flash, I thought, my goodness, what is that light? I had never seen such light before. At first, I was abruptly thrown back by the blast from the light. When I came to, I realized I was standing on bare soil with nothing on it, not even grass. In that moment, I did not have a clue what was going on.
She was lucky enough to climb out of the rubble by herself.
Others were buried under the rubble, unable to help themselves. My oldest sister was only 700 meters away and was buried under the house. She could not even shout for help or seek help in any way. When we found her, all that was left of her was white ash.
Sachiko's father was not with the family at the time. He was 800 meters from the hypercenter of the blast. He was among the few to receive treatment, traveling to a hospital in the town of Togitsu.
But he could not be helped. The hair on his head fell off immediately. High fever, diarrhea, and spots appeared on the skin. When these signs appeared, almost everybody died. In the end, the ones that were lost were my father, two brothers, an older sister, the wife of one older brother, and two aunts, making a total of seven persons.
The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki are a reminder of what horrors nuclear weapons can inflict, says Dr. Lassina Zerbo, Executive Secretary of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty.
With nuclear testing, countries can develop even more powerful nuclear weapons. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty makes it difficult for countries to proceed with such endeavor. At the CTBT, we stand ready to implement this treaty.
For Sachiko, who witnessed the horrors of the atomic bomb, to rid the world of nuclear weapons is the only answer.
In the beginning, we did not know what that light flash was that threw us back. But after knowing it was an atomic bomb, we really do not want it to be used another time. And so we wish for this weapon issue to be resolved as soon as possible.
Sachiko Matsuo said retelling this story is not an easy task, but it's something that must be done. Jerry Adams, United Nations.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's Global Reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.